panic, another shrinking back, in which, again, Temple was a leading participant.
"No one shoot!"
Sweet's gravel bass echoed from the darkness.
"That's all I need to crown my fucking day."
And the old scout stepped into the torchlight, hands up, shy behind him. The fellowship breathed a collective sigh of relief, in which Temple was among the loudest, and rolled away two barrels to let the negotiators into their makeshift fort.
"What happened? Did they talk? Are we safe?"
Sweet just stood there, hands on hips, slowly shaking his head. Shy frowned off at nothing. Savian came behind, narrowed eyes giving away as little as ever.
"Well?"
asked Mahood.
"Do we have a deal?"
"They're thinking it over," said Lamb, bringing up the rear.
"What did you offer? What happened, dammit?"
"He killed them," muttered Shy.
There was a moment of confused silence.
"Who killed who?"
squeaked Lord Ingolstadt.
"Lamb killed the ghosts."
"Don't overstate it," said Sweet. "He let one go."
And he pushed back his hat and sagged against a wagon tire.
"Sanjeet,"
grunted Crying Rock. Sweet shook his head.
"Oh,"
said the ghost.
"You killed them?"
asked Temple. Lamb shrugged.
"Out here, when a man tries to murder you, maybe you pay him for the favor. Where I come from, we got a different way of doing things."
"He killed them?"
asked Buckhorn, eyes wide with horror.
"Good,"
shouted his wife, shaking one small fist.
"Good, someone had the bones to do it. They got what they had coming, for my two dead boys." "We got eight still living to think about,"
said her husband.
"Not to mention every other person in this fellowship," added Lord Ingolstadt.
"He was right to do it," growled Savian. "For those that died and those that live. You trust those fucking animals out there? Pay a man to hurt you, all you do is teach him to do it again. Better they learn to fear us."
"So you say," snapped Hedges.
"That I do," said Savian, flat and cold. "Look on the upside. We might have saved a great deal of money here."
"Scant comfort if it costs us all our lives,"
snapped Buckhorn. The financial argument looked to have gone a long way towards bringing Mahood around, though.
"We should have made the choice together," he said.
"A choice between killing and dying ain't no choice at all."
And Lamb brushed through the gathering as though they were not there, and to an empty patch of grass beside the nearest fire.
"Hell of a fucking gamble, ain't it?"
"A gamble with our lives!"
"A chance worth taking."
"You are the expert," said Mahood to Sweet. "What do you say to this?"
The old scout rubbed at the back of his neck.
"What Subi said, it's done. Ain't no undoing it. Unless your niece is so good a healer she can stitch Sanjeet's head back on."
Savian did not answer.
"Didn't think so."
And Sweet climbed back up onto Mahood's wagon and perched in his place behind his arrow-prickled crate, staring out across the black plain, distinguishable from the black sky now only by its lack of stars. Temple had suffered some long and sleepless nights during his life. The night the Gurkish had finally broken through the walls and the Eaters had come for Cardia. The night the Inquisition had swept the slums of Dagoska for treason. The night his daughter died. And the night, not long after, when his wife followed. But he had lived through none longer than this. People strained their eyes into the inky nothing, occasionally raising breathless alarms at some imagined movement, the bubbling cries of one of the prospectors who had an arrow wound in his stomach and who Corlin did not expect to last until dawn as the backdrop. On Savian's order, since he had stopped making suggestions and taken unquestioned command, the fellowship lit torches and threw them out into the grass beyond the wagons. Their flickering light was almost worse than darkness, because at its edges death always lurked. Temple and Shai sat together in silence, with a palpable emptiness where Leif's place used to be, Lam's contented snoring stretching out the endless time. In the end, Shai nodded sideways and leaned against him and slept. He toyed with the idea of shouldering her off into the fire, but decided against. It could well have been his last chance to feel the touch of another person, after all, unless he counted the ghost who would kill him tomorrow. As soon as there was grey light enough to see by, Sweet, Crying Rock, and Savion mounted up and edged towards the trees. The rest of the fellowship gathered breathless on the wagons to watch, hollow-eyed from fear and lack of sleep, clutching at their weapons or at each other. The three riders came back into view not long after, calling out that in the lee of the timber there were fires still smoking on which the ghosts had burned their dead. But they were gone. It turned out they were practical thinkers after all. Now the enthusiasm for Lam's courage and swift action was unanimous. Luleen Buckholm and her husband were both tearful with gratitude on behalf of their dead sons. Gentili would have done just the same in his youth, apparently. Hedges would have done it if it weren't for his leg, injured in the line of duty at the Battle of Osrum. Two of the whores offered a reward in kind, which Lam looked minded to accept, until Shai declined on his behalf. Then Lestik clambered on a wagon and suggested in quavering tones that Lam be rewarded with 400 marks from the money saved, which he looked minded to refuse until Shai accepted on his behalf. Lord Ingolstad slapped Lam on the back and offered him a swig from his best bottle of brandy, aged for 200 years in the family cellars in faraway Keln, which were now, alas, the property of a creditor.
"My friend," said the nobleman, "you're a bloody hero."
Lam looked at him sideways as he raised the bottle.
"I'm bloody, all right."
The Fair Price. It was cold as hell up in them hills. The children all cold and scared, huddling together at night close to the fires with cheeks pinched and pinked and their breath smoking in each other's faces. Ro took Pitt's hands and rubbed them between hers and breathed on them and tried to wrap the bald furs tighter against the dark. Not long after they got off the boat, a man had come and said Papa Ring needed everyone, and Cantlas had cursed, which never took much, and sent 7 of his men off. That left just 6, with that bastard Blackpoint, but no one spoke of running now. No one spoke much at all, as if with each mile polled or rode or trod, the spirit went out of them, then the thought, and they became just meat on the hoof, trailing slack and wretched to whatever slaughterhouse Cantlas had in mind. The woman called B had been sent off too, and she'd cried and asked Cantlas,
"Where are you taking the children?"
And he'd sneered,
"Get back to Crease and mind your business, damn you."
So it was up to Ro and the boy Evan and a couple of the other older ones to see to the blisters and fears of the rest. High they went into the hills and higher, twisting by scarce-trodden ways cut by the water of long ago. They camped among great rocks that had the feel of buildings fallen, buildings ancient as the mountains. The trees grew taller and taller until they were pillars of wood that seemed to pierce the sky, their lowest branches high above, creaking in the silent forest, bare of brush, without animals, without insects.
"Where are you taking us?"
Ro asked Cantlas for the 100th time, and for the 100th time he said,
"On,"
jerking his unshaved face towards the grey outlines of the peaks beyond, his fancy clothes worn out to rags. They passed through some town, all wood-built and not built well, and a lean dog barked at them, but there were no people, not a one. Blackpoint frowned up at the empty windows and licked at the gap in his teeth and said,
"Where did they all go to?"
He spoke in Northern, but Lam had taught Roe enough to understand.
"I don't like it."
Cantlus just snorted.
"You ain't meant to."
Up and on, and the trees withered to brown and stunted pine, then twisted twig, then there were no trees. It turned from icy cold to strangely warm, the soft breeze across the mountainside like breath, and then too hot, too hot. The children toiling on, pink faces, sweat-beaded, up bare slopes of rock yellow with crusted sulphur, the ground warm to touch as flesh, the very land alive. Steam popped and hissed from cracks like mouths, and in cupped stones lay salt-crusted pools, the water bubbling with stinking gas, frothing with multicolored oils, and Cantlus warned them not to drink, for it was poison.
"This place is wrong," said Pitt. "It's just a place."
But Rose saw the fear in the eyes of the other children and in the eyes of Cantlus's men, and felt it too. It was a dead place.
"Is Shai still following?" "Of course she is."
But Roe didn't think she could be. Not so far as this. So far, it seemed they weren't in the world anymore. She could hardly remember what Shai looked like, or Lam, or the farm as it had been. She was starting to think all that was gone, a dream, a whisper, and this was all there was. The way grew too steep for horses, then for mules, so one man was left waiting with the animals. They climbed a deep, bare valley, where the cliffs were riddled with holes too square for nature to have made, heaped mounds of broken rock beside the way that put Roe in mind of the spoil of mines. But what ancient miners had delved here, and for what excavated in this blasted place, she could not guess. After a day breathing its ugly fume, noses and throats raw from the stink, they came upon a great needle of rock set on its end, pitted and stained by weather and time, but bare of moss or lichen or plant of any kind. As they came close in a group, all tattered reluctance, Roe saw it was covered with letters, and though she couldn't read them, knew it for a warning. In the rocky walls above, the blue sky so far away, were more holes, many more, and towering, creaking scaffolds of old wood held platforms, ropes, and buckets, and evidence of fresh diggings. Cantlus held up his open hand.
"Stop here!"
"What now?"
asked Blackpoint, fingering the hilt of his sword.
"Now we wait." "How long?"
"Not long, brother." A man leaned against a rock, quite at his ease. How Roe had missed him there she could not tell, because he was by no means small. Very tall and dark-skinned, head shaved to the faintest silver stubble, and he wore a simple robe of undyed cloth. In the crook of one heavy-muscled arm, he had a staff as tall as he was, in the other hand a small and wrinkled apple. Now he bit into it and said,
"Greetings,"
with his mouth half full, and he smiled at Cantlus and at Blackpoint and the other men, his face alive with friendly creases unfitting to these grim surroundings, and he smiled at the children, and at Roe in particular, she thought.
"Greetings, children."
"I want my money," said Cantlus.
The smile did not leave the old man's face.
"Of course, because you have a hole in you, and you believe gold will fill it."
"Because I got a debt, and if I don't pay, I'm a dead man."
"We are all dead men, brother, in due course. It is how we get there that counts. But you will have your fair price."
His eyes moved over the children.
"I count but 20.
"Long journey," said Blackpoint, one hand resting on his sword. "Bound to be some wastage."
"Nothing is bound to be, brother. What is so because of the choices we make.
I ain't the one buys children.
I buy them. I do not kill them. Is it the hurting of weak things that fills the hole in you?
I ain't got no hole in me, said Blackpoint.
The old man took a last bite from his apple.
No?
And he tossed the core to Blackpoint. The Northman reached for it on an instinct, then grunted. The old man had covered the ground between them in two lightning steps and struck him in the chest with the end of his staff. Blackpoint shuddered, letting fall the core and fumbling for his sword, but he had no strength left to draw it, and Roe saw it was not a staff but a spear, the long blade sticking bloody from Blackpoint's back. The old man lowered him to the ground, put a gentle hand on his face, and closed his eyes.
It is a hard thing to say, but I feel the world is better without him.
Roe looked at the Northman's corpse, clothes already dark with blood, and found that she was glad, and did not know what that meant.
By the dead,
breathed one of Cantlas's men, and looking up, Roe saw many figures had come silent from the mines and out onto the scaffolds looking down. Men and women of all races and ages, but all wearing the same brown cloth and all with heads shaved bald.
A few friends, said the old man, standing.
Cantlas's voice quavered, thin and wheedling.
We did our best.
It saddens me that this might be your best.
All I want is the money.
It saddens me that money might be all a man wants.
We had a deal.
That also saddens me. But so we did. Your money is there.
And the old man pointed out a wooden box sitting on a rock they had passed on the way.
I wish you joy of it.
Cantlas snatched up the box, and Roe saw the glitter of gold inside. He smiled, dirty face warm with the reflected glow.
Let's go.
And he and his men backed off. One of the little children started snivelling then, because little children will come to love even the hateful, if that is all they have. And Roe put a hand on her shoulder and said, shh, and tried to be brave as the old man walked up to stand towering over her. Pitt clenched his little fists and said,
don't hurt my sister.
The man swiftly knelt, so that his bald head was level with Rose, huge-looking so close, and he put one great hand gently upon Rose's shoulder and one upon Pitt's, and he said,
children, my name is Werdenur, the 39th right hand of the Maker, and I would never harm either one of you, nor allow anyone else so to do. I have sworn it. I have sworn to protect this sacred ground and the people upon it with my last blood and breath, and only death will stop me.
He brought out a fine chain and hung it around Roe's neck, and strung upon it, resting on her chest, was a piece of dull grey metal in the shape of a teardrop.
What's this? She asked.
It is a dragon's scale.
A real one?
Yes, a real one. We all have them.
He reached into his robe and pulled out his own to show to her.
Why do I have one?
He smiled, eyes glimmering with tears.
Because you are my daughter now.
And he put his arms around her and held her very tight. Part 3. Crease. The town, with less than 1,000 permanent residents, was filled with so much vileness that the very atmosphere appeared impregnated with the odor of abomination. Murder ran riot. Drunkenness was the rule. Gambling a universal pastime, fighting a recreation. J.W. Buell. Hell on the Cheap. Crease at night? Picture hell on the cheap, then add more whores. The greatest settlement of the new frontier, that prospector's paradise, the fellowship's long-anticipated destination, was wedged into a twisting valley, steep sides dotted with the wasted stumps of felled pines. It was a place of wild abandon, wild hope, wild despair. Everything at extremes and nothing in moderation, dreams trodden into the muck and new ones sucked from bottles to be vomited up and trodden down in turn. A place where the strange was commonplace and the ordinary bizarre, and death might be along tomorrow, so you'd best have all your fun today. At its muddy margins, the city consisted mostly of wretched tents, scenes better left unwitnessed by mankind assaulting the eye through wind-stirred flaps. Buildings were botched together from split pine and high hopes, held up by the drunks slumped against both sides, women risking their lives to lean from wonky balconies and beckon in the business. "It's got bigger," said Corlin, peering through the jam of wet traffic that clogged the main street.
"Lot bigger," grunted Savion.
"I'd have trouble saying better, though."
Chai was trying to imagine worse. A parade of crazed expressions reeled at them through the litter-strewn mud. Faces fit for some nightmare stage show. A demented carnival permanently in town. Off-key giggling split the jagged night, and moans of pleasure or horror, the calls of pawnbrokers and the snorts of livestock, the groaning of ruined bedsteads and the squeaking of ruined violins. All composing a desperate music together, no two bars alike, spilling into the night through ill-fitting doors and windows, roars of laughter at a joke or a good spin of the gaming wheel, hardly to be told, from roars of anger at an insult or the bad turn of a card.
"Merciful heaven," muttered Mahood,
one sleeve across his face against the ever-shifting stench.
"Enough to make a man believe in God," said Temple, "and that he's somewhere else."
Ruins loomed from the wet night. Columns on inhuman scale towered to either side of the main street, so thick three men couldn't have linked their arms around them. Some were toppled short, some sheared off 10 strides up, some still standing so high the tops were lost to the dark above, the shifting torchlight picking out stained carvings, letters, runes, in alphabets centuries forgotten, mementos of ancient happenings, winners and losers 1,000 years dust.
"What did this place used to be?" muttered Shai, neck aching from looking up.
"Cleaner, at a guess," said Lam.
Shacks had sprouted around those ancient columns like unruly fungi from the trunks of dead trees. Folk had built teetering scaffolds up them and chiseled bent props into them and hung ropes from the tops and even slung walkways between until some were entirely obscured by incompetent carpentry, turned to nightmare ships run thousands of miles aground, decked out in torches and lanterns and garish advertising for every vice imaginable, the whole so precarious you could see the buildings shifting when the breeze got stiff. The valley opened up as the remnants of the fellowship threaded its way further, and the general mood intensified to something between orgy, riot, and an outbreak of fever. Wild-eyed revelers rushed at it all open-mouthed, fixed on ripping through a lifetime of fun before sun-up, as if violence and debauch wouldn't be there on the morrow. Chai had a feeling they would.
"It's like a battle," grunted Savion.
"But without any sides," said Corlin.
"Or any victory," said Lam.
"Just 1,000,000 defeats," muttered Temple.
Men tottered and lurched, limped and spun with gaits grotesque or comical, drunk beyond reason, or crippled in head or body, or half mad from long months spent digging alone in high extremities where words were a memory. Shai directed her horse around a man making a spatter all down his own bare legs, trousers about ankles in the muck, cock in one wobbling hand while he slobbered at a bottle in the other.
"Where the hell do you start?" Shai heard Goldie asking her pimp.
He had no answer. The competition was humbling, all right. The women came in every shape, color, and age, lolling in the national undress of a score of different nations and displaying flesh by the acre. Goose flesh, mostly, since the weather was tending chilly. Some cooed and simpered or blew kisses. Others shrieked unconvincing promises about the quality of their services at the torchlit dark. Still others abandoned even that much subtlety and thrust their hips at the passing fellowship with the most warlike expressions. One let a pair of pendulous blue-veined teats dangle over the rail of a balcony and called out,
"What do you think of these?"
Shai thought they looked about as appealing as a pair of rotten hams. You never can tell what'll light the fire in some folk, though. A man looked up eagerly with one hand down the front of his trousers, noticeably yanking away. Others stepping around him, like a wank in the street, was nothing to remark upon. Shai blew out her cheeks.
"I've been to some low-down places, and I done some low-down shit when I got there, but I never saw the like of this."
"Likewise," muttered Lam, frowning about, with one hand resting on the hilt of his sword. Seemed to Shai it rested there a lot these days, and had got pretty comfortable, too. He weren't the only one with steel to hand, mind you. The air of menace was thick enough to chew, gangs of ugly-faced and ugly-purposed men haunting the porches, armed past their armpits, aiming flinty frowns across at groups no better favoured on the other side of the way. While they were stopped waiting for the traffic to clear, a thug with too much chin and nowhere near enough forehead stepped up to Mahood's wagon and growled,
"Which side of the street you on?"
Never a man to be rushed, Mahood considered a moment before answering,
"I have purchased a plot on which I mean to cite a business, but until I see it..."
"He ain't talking about plots, fool,"
snorted another tough, with hair so greasy he looked like he'd dipped his head in cold stew.
"He means, are you on the mayor's side or Papa Ring's side?"
"I am here to do business."
Mahood snapped his reins and his wagon lurched on.
"Not to take sides."
"Only thing on neither side of the street is the sewer,"
shouted Chinny after him.
"You want to go in the fucking sewer, do you?"
The way grew wider and busier still, a crawling sea of muck, the columns even higher above it, the ruin of an ancient theatre cut from the hillside where the valley split in two ahead of them. Sweet was waiting near a sprawling heap of building, like 100 shacks piled on top of each other. Looked as if some optimist had taken a stab at it with whitewash, but given up halfway and left the rest to slowly peel, like a giant lizard in the midst of molting.
"This here is Papa Ring's emporium of romance, song, and dry goods, known locally as the White House,"
Sweet informed Shai as she hitched her horse.
"Over yonder,"
and the old scout nodded across the stream that split the street in two, serving at once for drinking water and sewer, and crossed by a muddle of stepping stones, wet planks, and improvised bridges,
"is the mayor's Church of Dice."
The mayor had occupied the ruins of some old temple, a set of pillars with half a moss-caked pediment on top, and filled in the gaps with a riot of planks to consecrate a place of worship for some very different idols.
"Though being honest," continued Sweet, "they both offer fucking drink and gambling, so the distinction is largely in the signage. Come on, the mayor's keen to meet you."
He stepped back to let a wagon clatter past, showering mud from its back wheels over all and sundry, then set off across the street.
"What shall I do?"
called Temple, still on his mule with a face full of panic.
"Take in the sights. Reckon there's a lifetime of material for a preacher. But if you're tempted by a sample, don't forget you got debts.
Shai forded the road after Lam, trying to pick the firmest patches as the slop threatened to suck her boots right off. Around a monstrous boulder, she realized was the head of a fallen statue, half its face mud-sunk, while the other half still wore a pitted frown of majesty. Then up the steps of the Mayor's Church of Dice, between two groups of frowning thugs, and into the light. The heat was a slap, such a reek of sweltering bodies that Shai, no stranger to the unwashed, felt for a moment like she might drown in it. Fires were stoked high, and the air was hazy with their smoke, and chagger smoke, and the smoke from cheap lamps burning cheap oil with a fizz and sputter, and her eyes set right away to watering. Stained walls, half-green wood and half-moss-crusted stone, trickled with the wet of desperate breath. Mounted in alcoves above the swarming humanity were a dozen sets of dusty imperial armor that must have belonged to some general of antiquity and his guards, the proud past staring down in faceless disapproval at the sorry now.
"It gets worse," muttered Lam.
"What gets better?" asked Sweet.
The air rang with the rattle of thrown dice and bellowed odds, thrown insults and bellowed warnings. There was a band banging away like their lives were at stake, and some drunken prospectors were singing along, but didn't know even a quarter of the words and were making up the balance with swears at random. A man reeled past, clutching at a broken nose, and blundered into the counter, gleaming wood, and more unlikely the only thing in the place that came near clean, stretching what looked like half a mile, and every inch crammed with clients clamoring for drink. Stepping back, Shai nearly tripped over a card game. One of the players had a woman astride him, sucking at his face like he'd a gold nugget down his gullet, and with just a bit more effort, she'd get her tongue around it.
"Dab Sweet?"
called a man with a beard seemed to go right up to his eyes, slapping the scout on the arm.
"Look! Sweet's back!"
"Aye, and brought a fellowship with me."
"No trouble with old Sanjeed on the way?"
"There was," said Sweet, "as a result of which, he's dead."
"Dead?"
"No doubt of that."
He jerked his thumb at Lam.
"It was this lad did..."
But the man with all the beard was already clambering up on the nearest table, sending glasses, cards, and counters clattering.
"Listen up, all of you! Dab Sweet killed that fucker Sanjeed! That old ghost bastard's dead!"
"A cheer for Dab Sweet!"
someone roared. A surge of approval battered the mildewed rafters, and the band struck up an even wilder tune than before.
"Hold on," said Sweet. "Wasn't me killed him."
Lam steered him on.
"Silence is the warrior's best armor, the saying goes. Just show us to the mayor."
They threaded through the heaving crowd, past a cage where a pair of clerks weighed out gold dust and coins in 100 currencies, and transformed it through the alchemy of the abacus to gambling chips and back. A few of the men Lam brushed out of the way didn't much care for it, turned with a harsh word in mind, but soon reconsidered when they saw his face. Same face that, slack and sorry, boys used to laugh at back in Square Deal. He was a man much changed since those days, all right, or maybe just a man revealed. A couple of nail-eyed thugs blocked the bottom of the stairs, but Sweet called,
"These two are here to see the mayor,"
and bundled them up with a deal of backslappery along a balcony overlooking the swarming hall and to a heavy door flanked by two more hard faces.
"Here we go,"
said Sweet, and knocked. It was a woman who answered.
"Welcome to Crease," she said. She wore a black dress with a shine to the fabric, long-sleeved and buttoned all the way to her throat. Late in her 40s, was Shai's guess, hair streaked with grey. She must have been quite the beauty in her day, though, and her day weren't entirely past, either. She took Shai's hand in one of hers and clasped it with the other one besides and said,
You must be shy. And Lamb.
She gave Lamb's weathered paw the same treatment, and he thanked her too late in a creaky voice, and took his battered hat off as an afterthought, sparse hair overdue for a cut, left flapping at all angles. But the woman smiled like she'd never been treated to so gallant a gesture. She shut the door, and with its solid click into the frame, the madness outside was shut away, and all was calm and reasonable.
"Do sit. Master Sweet has told me of your troubles, your stolen children. A terrible thing."
And she had such pain in her face, you'd have thought it was her babies had vanished.
"Aye,"
muttered Shy, not sure what to do with that much sympathy.
"Would either of you care for a drink?"
She poured four healthy measures of spirit without need for an answer.
"Please forgive this place. It's a struggle to get good furniture out here, as you can imagine."
"Guess we'll manage," said Shy, even though it was about the most comfortable chair she'd ever sat in and about the nicest room besides. Cantic hangings at the windows, candles in lamps of coloured glass, a great desk with a black leather top just a little stained with bottle rings. She'd real fine manners, Shy thought, this woman, as she handed out the drinks. Not that haughty, down-the-nose kind that idiots thought lifted you above the crowd. The kind that made you feel you were worth something, even if you were dog-tired and dog-filthy, and had near worn the arse out of your trousers, and not even you could tell how many 100 miles of dusty plain you'd covered since your last bath. Shy took a sip, noted the drink was just as far out of her class as everything else, cleared her throat, and said,
"We were hoping to see the mayor."
The woman perched herself against the edge of the desk, Shy had a feeling she'd have looked comfortable sitting on an open razor, and said,
"You are?"
"Hoping."
"Seeing her."
Lamb shifted awkwardly in his chair, like it was too comfortable for him to be comfortable in.
"You're a woman?"
asked Shy, head somewhat scrambled from the hell outside and the clean calm in here. The mayor only smiled. She did that a lot, but somehow you never tired of it.
"They have other words for what I am on the other side of the street, but yes."
She tossed down her drink in a way that suggested it wasn't her first, wouldn't be her last, and wouldn't make much difference either.
"Sweet tells me you're looking for someone."
"Man by the name of Gregor Cantless," said Shy.
"I know Cantless. Preening scum. He robs and murders for Papa Ring."
"Where can we find him?" asked Lamb.
"I believe he's been out of town, but I expect he'll be back before long."
"How long are we talking about?" asked Shy.
43 days.
That kicked the guts out of her. She'd built herself up to good news, or at least to news, kept herself going with thoughts of Pitt and Rose smiling faces and happy hugs of reunion. Should have known better, but hope's like damp. However much you try to keep it out, there's always a little gets in. She knocked back the balance of her drink, not near so sweet now, and hissed,
"Shit."
"We've come a long way." Lamb carefully placed his own glass on the desk, and Shy noticed with a hint of worry his knuckles were white with pressure. "I appreciate your hospitality, no doubt I do, but I ain't in any mood to fuck around. Where's Cantless?"
"I'm rarely in the mood to fuck around either."
The rough word sounded double harsh in the mayor's polished voice, and she held Lamb's eye like, manners or no, she wasn't someone to be pushed around.
"Cantless will be back in 43 days.
Shy had never been one to mope. A moment to tongue at the gap between her teeth and dwell on all the unfairness the world inflicted on her undeserving carcass, and she was on to the what next.
"Where's the magic in 43 days?
"That's when things are coming to a head here in Crease."
Shy nodded towards the window and the sounds of madness drifting through.
"Strikes me they always are."
"Not like this one."
The mayor stood and offered out the bottle.
"Why not?"
said Shy. and Lamb and Sweet were turning down nothing either. Refusing to drink in Crease seemed wrong-headed as refusing to breathe, especially when the drink was so fine and the air so shitty. 8 years we've been here, Papa Ring and I, staring across the street at each other. The mayor drifted to the window and looked out at the babbling carnage below. She had a trick of walking so smooth and graceful it seemed it must be done with wheels rather than legs. There was nothing on the map out here but a crease when we arrived. 20 shacks among the ruins, places where trappers could see out the winter. Sweet chuckled.
You were quite a sight among them.
They soon got used to me. 8 years while the town grew up around us. We outlasted the plague, and 4 raids by the ghosts, and 2 more by bandits, and the plague again. And after the big fire came through, we rebuilt bigger and better, and were ready when they found the gold and the people started coming. 8 years staring across the street at each other, and snapping at each other, and in the end all but at war.
You gonna come near a point? Asked Shai.
Our feud was getting bad for business. We agreed to settle it according to mining law, which is the only kind out here for the moment, and I can assure you people take it very seriously. We treated the town as a plot with 2 rival claims, winner takes all.
Winner of what? Asked Lam.
A fight. Not my choice, but Papa Ring maneuvered me into it. A fight. Man against man, bare-fisted, in a circle marked out in the old amphitheater.
A fight in the circle, muttered Lam. To the death, I dare say.
I understand more often than not that's where these things end up. Master Sweet tells me you may have some experience in that area. Lam looked over at Sweet, then glanced at Shai, then back to the mayor and grunted,
some.
There was a time, not all that long ago, Shai would have laughed her ass off at the notion of Lam in a fight to the death. Nothing could have been less funny now. Sweet was chuckling as he put down his empty glass, though.
I reckon we can drop the pretense, eh?
What pretense? Asked Shai.
Lam, said Sweet. That's what. You know what I call a wolf wearing a sheep mask?
Lam looked back at him.
I've a feeling you can't keep it to yourself. A wolf?
The old scout wagged a finger across the room, looking quite decidedly pleased with himself.
I had a crazy guess about you the moment I saw a big 9-fingered Northman kill the hell out of 2 drifters back in Avostock. When I saw you crush Sanjeed like a beetle, I was sure. I must admit it did occur when I asked you along that you and the mayor might be the answer to each other's problems.
Ain't you a clever little bastard? Snarled Lam, eyes burning and the veins suddenly popping from his thick neck.
Best be careful when you pull that mask off, fucker. You might not like what's under there.
Sweet twitched. Shai flinched. The comfortable room of a sudden feeling balanced on the brink of a great pit, and that an awful, dangerous place for a chat. Then the mayor smiled, as if this was all a joke between friends, gently took Lamb's trembling hand and filled his glass, fingers lingering on his just a moment. Papa Rings brought in a man to fight for him, she carried on, smooth as ever, a Northman by the name of Golden. Glamour Golden. Lam shrank back into his chair, like he'd been embarrassed by his own temper.
I've heard the name, said Shai.
Heard it'd be a fool who'd bet against him in a fight.
That would depend who he was fighting. None of my men is a match for him. But you? She leaned forwards, and the sweet whiff of perfume, rare as gold among the reeks of Crease, even got Shai a little warm under the collar. Well, from what Sweet tells me, you're more than a match for anyone. There was a time Shai would have laughed her ass off at that, too. Now she wasn't even near a chuckle.
Might be my best years are behind me, muttered Lam.
Come now,
I don't think either one of us is over the hill quite yet. I need your help, and I can help you.
The mayor looked Lamb in the face, and he looked back like no one else was even there. Shai got a worried feeling then, like she'd somehow been out-bartered by this woman without prices even being mentioned.
"What's to stop us finding the children some other how?"
she snapped, her voice sounding harsh as a graveyard crow's.
"Nothing," said the mayor simply. "But if you want Cantless, Papa Ring will put himself in your way, and I'm the only one who can get him out of it. Would you say that's fair, Dab?"
"I'd say it's true," said Sweet, still looking a little unnerved. "Fair, I'll leave to better judges."
"But you needn't decide now. I'll arrange a room for you over at Camling's hostelry. It's the closest thing to neutral ground we have here. If you can find your children without my help, go with my blessing. If not," and the mayor gave them one more smile, "I'll be here."
"Till Papa Ring kicks you out of town?"
Her eyes flickered to Shai's, and there was anger there, hot and sharp. Just for a moment, then she shrugged.
"I'm still hoping to stay."
And she poured another round of drinks. Plots.
"It is a plot," said Temple.
Mahood slowly nodded.
"Undeniably."
"Beyond that," said Temple, "I would not like to venture." Mahood slowly shook his head.
"Nor I, even as its owner."
It appeared the amount of gold in Crease had been drastically overstated, but no one could deny there had been a mudstrike here of epic proportions. There was the treacherous slop that constituted the main street, and in which everyone was forced to take their wading, cursing, shuffling chances. There was the speckly filth that showered from every wagon wheel to inconceivable heights when it was raining, sprinkling every house, column, beast, and person. There was an insidious, watery muck that worked its way up from the ground, leaching into wood and canvas and blooming forth with moss and mould, leaving black tide marks on the hems of every dress in town. There was an endless supply of dung, shit, crap, and night soil, found in every colour and configuration, and often in the most unlikely places. Finally, of course, there was the all-pervasive moral filth. Mahood's plot was rich in all of these and more. An indescribably haggard individual stumbled from one of the wretched tents, pitched higgledy-piggledy upon it, hawked up at great length and volume, and spat upon the rubbish-strewn mud. Then he turned the most bellicose of expressions towards Mahood and Temple, scratched at his infested beard, dragged up his decaying full-body undershirt so it could instantly slump once more, and returned to the unspeakable darkness whence he came.
"The location is good," said Mahood.
"Excellent," said Temple.
"Right on the main street."
Although Crease was so narrow that it was virtually the only street. Daylight revealed a different side to the thoroughfare. No cleaner, perhaps even less so, but at least the sense of a riot in a madhouse had faded. The flood of intoxicated criminals between the ruined columns had become a more respectable trickle. The whorehouses, gaming pits, husk shacks, and drinking dens were no doubt still taking customers, but no longer advertising as if the world would end tomorrow. Premises with less spectacular strategies for fleecing passers-by came to the fore. Eateries, money changers, pawn shops, blacksmiths, stables, butchers, combined stables and butchers, ratters and hatters, animal and fur traders, land agents and mineral consultancies, merchants in mining equipment of the most execrable quality, and a postal service, whose representative Temple had seen dumping letters in a stream scarcely even out of town. Groups of bleary prospectors slogged miserably back to their claims, probably in hopes of scraping enough gold dust from the freezing stream beds for another night of madness. Now and again, a dishevelled fellowship came chasing their diverse dreams into town, usually wearing the same expressions of horror and amazement that Mahood and Temple had worn when they first arrived. That was Crease for you, a place where everyone was passing through.
"I have a sign," said Mahood, patting it affectionately.
It was painted clean white with gilt lettering and proclaimed, "Mahood and Kernsbick Metalwork. Hinges, nails, tools, wagon fixings, high-quality smithing of all varieties." Then it said, "Metalwork" in five other languages. A sensible precaution in Crease, where it sometimes seemed no two people spoke quite the same tongue, let alone read it. In Northern, it had been spelled wrong, but it was still vastly superior to most of the gaudy shingles dangling over the main street. A building across the way sported a red one, on which yellow letters had run into drips on the bottom edge. It read simply, "Fuck Palace."
"I brought it all the way from Adua," said Mahood. "It is a noble sign, and embodies your high achievement in coming so far. All you need now is a building to hang it on."
The merchant cleared his throat, its prominent knobble bobbing.
"I remember house builder being among your impressive list of previous professions."
"I remember you being unimpressed," said Temple.
"We need no houses out here," were your very words.
"You have a sharp memory for conversations, those on which my life depend in particular."
"Must I apologize at the start of our every exchange?"
"I see no pressing reason why not."
"Then I apologize. I was wrong. You have proved yourself a staunch traveling companion, not to mention a valued leader of prayer."
A stray dog limped across the plot, sniffed at a turd, added one of its own, and moved on.
"Speaking as a carpenter..."
"Ex-carpenter.
How would you go about building on this plot?"
"If you held a knife to my throat..." Temple stepped forwards. His boot sank in well beyond the ankle, and it was only with considerable effort he was able to drag it squelching free.
"The ground is not the best," Mahood was forced to concede.
"The ground is always good enough if one goes deep enough. We would begin by driving piles of fresh hardwood."
"That task would require a sturdy fellow. I will have to see if Master Lamb can spare us a day or two."
"He is a sturdy fellow.
I would not care to be a pile under his hammer."
"Nor I." Temple had felt very much like a pile under a hammer ever since he had abandoned the company of the Gracious Hand and was hoping to stop. "A hardwood frame upon the piles, then, jointed and pegged, beams to support a floor of pine plank to keep your customers well clear of the mud, front of the ground floor for your shop, rear for office and workshop. Contract a mason for a chimney stack and a stone-built addition to house your forge. On the upper floor, quarters for you. A balcony overlooking the street appears to be the local fashion. You may festoon it with semi-naked women, should you so desire."
"I will probably avoid the local fashion to that degree."
"A steeply pitched roof would keep off the winter rains and accommodate an attic for storage or employees." The building took shape in Temple's imagination, his hand sketching out the rough dimensions, the effect only slightly spoiled by a clutch of feral ghost children frolicking naked in the shit-filled stream beyond. Mahood gave a curt nod of approval.
"You should have said architect rather than carpenter."
"Would that have made any difference?"
"To me it would. But don't tell me not to Kernsbick. His heart is of iron."
"I got one!"
A filth-crusted individual rode squelching down the street into town, pushing his blown nag as fast as it would hobble, one arm raised high, as though it held the word of the Almighty.
"I got one!"
he roared again. Temple caught the telltale glint of gold in his hand. Men gave limp cheers, called out limp congratulations, gathered around to clap the prospector on the back as he slid from his horse, hoping perhaps his good fortune might rub off.
"One of the lucky ones,"
said Mahood, as they watched him waddle, bow-legged, up the steps into the mayor's church of Dice, a dishevelled crowd trailing after, eager at the chance even of seeing a nugget. "I fully expect he'll be destitute by lunchtime," said Temple.
"You give him that long?"
One of the tent flaps was thrust back. A grunt from within, and an arc of piss emerged, spattered against the side of one of the other tents, sprinkled the mud, drooped to a dribble, and stopped. The flap closed. Mahood gave vent to a heavy sigh.
"In return for your help in constructing the edifice discussed, I would be prepared to pay you the rate of 1 mark a day."
Temple snorted.
"Kernsbeck has not chased all charity from the circle of the world, then? The fellowship may be dissolved, but still I feel a certain duty of care towards those I travelled with. That, or you expected to find a carpenter here, but now perceive the local workmanship to be inferior."
Temple cocked a brow at the building beside the plot, every door and window frame at its own wrong angle, leaning sideways even with the support of an ancient stone block half sunk in the ground.
"Perhaps you would like a place of business that will not wash away in the next shower. Does the weather get harsh here, do you suppose, in winter?"
A brief pause, while the wind blew up chill and made the canvas of the tents flap and the wood of the surrounding buildings creak alarmingly.
"What fee would you demand?" asked Mahood.
Temple had been giving serious consideration to the idea of slipping away and leaving his debt to Shy South forever stalled at 76 marks. But the sad fact was he had nowhere to slip to and no one to slip with, and was even more useless alone than in company. That left him with money to find.
3 marks a day.
A quarter of what Koska used to pay him, but 10 times his wages riding drag. Mahood clicked his tongue.
"Ridiculous! That is the lawyer in you speaking." "He is a close friend of the carpenter." "How do I know your work will be worth the price? I challenge you to find anyone less than entirely satisfied with the quality of my joinery." "You have built no houses here."
"Then yours shall be unique. Customers will flock to see it."
1.5 marks a day. Any more, and Kurzbeck will have my head."
"I would hate to have your death upon my conscience."
2 it is, with meals and lodging provided."
And Temple held out his hand. Mahood regarded it without enthusiasm.
"Shy South has set an ugly precedent for negotiation. Her ruthlessness approaches Master Kernsbeck's. Perhaps they should go into business together." "If 2 jackals can share a carcass..."
They shook. Then they considered the plot again. The intervening time had in no way improved it.
"The first step would be to clear the ground," said Mahood.
"I agree. Its current state is a veritable offence against God, not to mention public health." Another occupant had emerged from a structure of mildewed cloth sagging so badly that it must have been virtually touching the mud inside. This one wore nothing but a long grey beard, not quite long enough to protect his dignity, or at least everyone else's, and a belt with a large knife sheathed upon it. He sat down in the dirt and started chewing savagely at a bone.
"Master Lamb's help might come in useful there also."
"Doubtless." Mahood clapped him on the shoulder.
"I shall seek out the Northmen while you begin the clearance."
"Me? Who else?"
"I am a carpenter, not a bailiff. A day ago you were a priest and cattleman, and a moment before that a lawyer. A man of your varied talents will, I feel sure, find a way."
And Mahood was already hopping briskly off down the street. Temple rolled his eyes from the earthbound refuse to the clean blue heavens.
"I'm not saying I don't deserve it, but you surely love to test a man."
Then he hitched up his trouser legs and stepped gingerly towards the naked beggar with the bone, limping somewhat, since the buttock Shy pricked on the plains was still troubling him in the mornings.
"Good day!"
he called. The man squinted up at him, sucking a strip of gristle from his bone.
I don't fucking think so. You got a drink?
I thought it best to stop.
Then you need a good fucking reason to bother me, boy.
I have a reason. Whether you will consider it a good one, I profoundly doubt.
You can but try.